I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We gonna go into the Super Bowl again, being all right.
You're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast, the official UK podcast for the Seattle Seahawks. Here are your hosts, Ross Bell, Stuart Court, and Adam Nathan. Go Hawks!
Welcome back to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast. The off-season is slowly turning, the wheels are slowly turning on the off-season for the Seahawks with the playoffs in full swing with NFC and AFC conference games this weekend. But with all the coaching carousel in full swing in Seattle, with me, myself and Adam, I've reconvened. How are we, Adam?
I'm not bad. It's quite nice to be fairly compos mentis for this show, because having thought back to what we talked about last week in the midst of some of the worst man flu ever seen that I was suffering from, I realise I have absolutely no idea what we discussed. So obviously the day and night nurse was working a treat, but I'll probably end up repeating stuff, but I'm sure the listener won't mind that too much.
No, I can't really remember it, and I was fully with it, I think. But yeah, I joined myself, Adam, collected his hat-trick ball, I believe, or maybe it's the quadruple appearance, BBC Radio Sheffield, and the man behind Seahawks draft blog, Rob Staton. How are we, Rob?
Yeah, really good. Wish the Seahawks were still playing, of course, yeah. But yeah, at least we get to talk about offensive coordinators and defensive coordinators instead, because that's just as fun.
Yeah. Look, we really want to miss out on Stephon Diggs lighting up Minnesota on Sunday, didn't we?
Well, what a game that was.
Was it four lead changes in the final 3 minutes, wasn't it? Mm. Something stupid. But yeah, obviously, since last time we spoke, Adam, I know you can't remember. The Seahawks have hired the coaches they fired last week. So before we get into that, though, Rob, what were your thoughts on how the season ended? It was a bit of a damp squib at the end of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and I hate to say, but it kind of felt like halfway through the season that it was going to go that way. You know, 10 yeah. wins, 9 wins, you just had a feeling of being that type of year. Nothing was really going right. When you get to halfway through the year and the running game's still what it was, and then it just never really improved. It never got going at any point. When the injuries started happening, I think it was after the Arizona game when they lost Richard Sherman and Cam Chancellor for the season in that same game, that you kind of felt like, this isn't going to happen this year. You know, they've just lost so many players, just so many things that aren't right. And then, you know, what a fitting way to end the season, that having found a way to come back against Arizona, and you think, well, at least they're going to finish with a victory. They're not going to get in the playoffs, but they are going to win the last game. Blair Walsh shanks another kick and the season's over. So, yeah, it was a major disappointment, and I'm not surprised that we've seen major change from Pete Carroll since.
No, yeah, it is. No, it really wasn't a surprising way to end, was it, Adam? But yeah, the Seahawks have moved to hire a new offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, and a few position coaches as well. The first name which came out, I think, Friday or Saturday of last week was the former New York Jets OC and former Georgia OC, and the guy who spent 2017 season as the quarterback coach in Indianapolis, Brian Schottenheimer, was hired as the team's offensive coordinator. This is all just a return to run the ball and just getting that back on track after a down year or two, isn't it, Rob?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I think this is just Pete Carroll essentially bringing people in who are going to try and deliver on his very defined identity. You know, one of the problems the Seahawks had when Jim Mora was in charge, you know, that sort of period between Holmgren and Carroll, was that it was really hard to work out exactly what Jim Mora's vision was for the team, what his identity was. And then Carroll comes in and he laid it out, you know, immediately. This is what I want to do. This is what we're going to do. And you could see it in place within, you know, 18 months of him being in charge, when they finally got halfway through that 2011 season and Marshawn Lynch was running, they were playing physical defense. You could see the only thing they were missing was a quarterback, and then Russell Wilson came along. So the last 2 years, they've not had that. The running game has been miserable. The defense has regressed a little bit. You know, that the injuries, of course, have played a big part in that, but they've just not reached the same standards that they had in the past either. And they need to get back to it. And I think Carroll wants certain players held a little bit more accountable. And it's hard to do that with the same faces, same voices in charge in terms of the key assistant positions. Carroll has stayed. You know, he's not moved on. So he clearly feels like he needs to change the people beneath him. And I think that Schottenheimer coming in is a guy who's very dedicated to the running game. And, you know, I think Rex Ryan told the story a few days ago that, you know, if he said to run it 40 times when Schottenheimer was the Jets offensive coordinator, then he would run it 40 times. So that's what I think Pete Carroll's looking for.
Yeah, in Schottenheimer's 1 year as the Georgia Bulldogs OC, they averaged 37 rush attempts per game with Nick Chubb, Keith Marshall, and a selection of other running backs. Adam, your thoughts on Schottenheimer?
I don't necessarily have any thoughts on him as an individual because I don't know enough about, you know, the statistics and whatever. But I think what you can certainly tell by all of the changes this week are Pete Carroll has wrestled control back of the team, and this is now 100% his baby again. I mean, from all accounts, if you know, reading in between the lines, it seems like there was, you know, a couple of coordinators that not exactly doing things exactly the way he wanted them to be. And I think certainly from an accountability point of view, right now we know that if it works out or if it doesn't work out, I think it's pretty squarely on Pete Carroll. But it did make me laugh a little bit that last week he was talking about, you know, we've got to respect these guys because they got families. And then, you know, fast forward a week, he reminded me of Michael Corleone becoming the godfather to the child renouncing Satan. And all of a sudden, you know, Mo Green's being shot in the eye, Clemenza's doing people when they're in their bed. I mean, it was like he was purging the Seahawks of all the bad things and sort of, you know, bringing it in-house and becoming the Michael Corleone godfather boss of the team, if that's not too ridiculous an analogy, which it almost certainly is.
Yeah, I kind of got lost halfway through that analogy. Obviously, along with Schottenheimer, along with possibly the return to the run game, the team also hired Mike Solari, who spent 2017 as the O-line coach for the New York Giants, had previously spent 2 years as the offensive line coach in Seattle. I think he was the final year with Holmgren and the Jim Mora year. But the hiring of Solari along with Schottenheimer is just further emphasizes the want to get the run game going again, Rob, again.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting about these appointments is they all kind of feel relatively immediate and short-term. There's no appointment of a young upcoming coach. No. You could be an heir apparent. There's no assistant, as far as I'm aware, there's no assistant head coach that's been named. You know, the two that were there, you know, Michael Barrow, the linebackers coach, was an assistant head coach. So was Tom Cable. There's nobody being put on a platform level with Pete Carroll. This is essentially his show. He's brought people in beneath him who either he's familiar with or he's familiar with the style that they want to incorporate on either side of the ball, or it's people who he's worked with and know his system and his way of doing things. So it just seems like, do you know what? This is my show. I'm going to go out on my terms. If we're not going to win another title in the next couple of years, then I want it to be on me, not on the coordinators. It's going to be my identity. It's going to be my vision. We need to get back to that. It's not the most exciting set of hirings. You know, I think that the reaction from fans has probably been slightly underwhelming, but Carroll's doing what he thinks he needs to do to, as was mentioned there, you know, to establish control and to get back to his way of doing things. So we have to wait and see if he can do that, because they've been a long way off doing the things that he wants to do for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
As a gut feeling, Rob, what do you think about the workability of a system that Carroll wants to put in place? I mean, I've always slightly worried that he's turning into a bit of an Arsene Wenger of the NFL and sort of staying so true to a style that is perhaps becoming a little bit passé. Do you think the way he clearly wants to set his team up is a way that can still win in such a, you know, such an ever-changing league?
If you'd have asked me that question about 7 weeks ago, then I probably would have agreed with you, or at least sort of had a lot of sympathy for that point. Because you were seeing teams like the Rams, for example, and the success that they were having. The Rams will play a bad team and they'll be 20-0 up at the end of the first quarter and the game's over. And that's how a lot of those teams are winning. And you look at obviously the Patriots and the Steelers and the highly charged, powerful offenses, a lot of spread systems, sort of lending schemes and philosophies from the college game. You see that. And yet here we are, and we're watching four teams left in the playoffs. And one of them's quarterbacked by Nick Foles, and they run the ball well and they play good defense. One's by Case Keenum, who's had a fantastic year, but they still run the ball and play great defense. We've got the Jacksonville Jaguars, who've got Blake Bortles, who played great defense and run the ball. And that is almost the perfect illustration that what Carroll is trying to do can still succeed. And maybe the Rams might win the NFC West for the next 2 or 3 years because of their talent and their ability to sort of beat the bad teams, which is something that the Seahawks generally tend to play down to teams. So they allow bad teams to stay in games longer than they should do. The Rams, I don't think, are going to have that problem. So the Rams might win the NFC West for the next 2 or 3 years. If the Seahawks get into a wild card, though, they might be the tougher team in the playoffs, because it certainly seems that running the ball and playing great defense is still the thing that wins championships. So I think that seeing the three of the four teams that are left in the playoffs is actually quite encouraging for the way Carroll wants to play.
Yeah, and also with that, how the Rams season ended against the Falcons and with Dan Quinn, that's sort of what they, how they approached that game in Los Angeles. When they ran the ball with Freeman and Coleman and shut down Todd Gurley, both pass and run game, didn't they? That kind of emphasizes that.
Watching that game, they set out to stop Todd Gurley, or to not to stop him, but to limit Todd Gurley and try and put the game on Goff. And Goff was not up to winning that contest. And if you watch all of the Rams' losses, they're almost identical versions. You know, they lost to Washington at home, they lost to Seattle at home, they lost to Philadelphia at home. And these were games where it was actually put on Goff to try and keep up and match up and be this sort of big franchise quarterback. He can't do it. Todd Gurley is their key to victory. And if you play strong defense and stop the run and make him try and beat you, Goff isn't up to that right now. Maybe he will be in a few years, but right now he isn't. And I'm not confident that he's ever going to get to that level. And then if you can make enough plays on that defense, great up front as they are with Aaron Donald and co, not as great on the back end. If you can make enough plays there and you can keep the scoreboard ticking over, that Falcons win was very similar to Seattle's win when they won in LA, at least into that first half, first three quarters. And that is the way to beat teams like the Rams. And I think that the Rams, like I say, will blow away bad teams, but might struggle against the teams that are able to limit Todd Gurley and play defense.
Yeah, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, be very upsetting times for Michael Silver again, which can only be delightful for me to read about that. And so the Todd Gurley thing, I'm just going to segue slightly into something that Seahawk Twitter's been a bit of a buzz about, and sorry if I'm taking us off schedule a little bit, Stu, but the importance of the running back itself. I mean, you've been embroiled in loads of conversations about this recently, Rob, whereby a lot of people are saying that the run game just doesn't even matter, and certainly what doesn't matter even more is the running back that you've got that's doing it, and people will give you stats about Fournette versus the other Jacksonville guys and Elliott versus the other Cowboys guys. You don't subscribe to that view, and we had Nathan Ernst on sort of being anti-rush, but I'm interested to hear your view, because I think I side with you sort of probably more than the other side of things, but I think it's always good to get both sides of it.
Listen, I enjoy reading some of these pieces, and there's definitely some methodology and some accuracy in what they say. And if you break down the numbers, the, you know, passing efficiency is very important. The thing is, though, is I just think that there is a real danger among Seahawks Twitter, and I think this is kind of infested and has grown, and more people have latched onto this. It's just become too much. It's become, you know, football is not a maths quiz. Mm-hmm. And you can't judge everything based on what a set of numbers tell you. And I'm sure if you put the numbers into the system and said, why are Jacksonville doing well? Nothing will tell you it's because of anything that Blake Bortles has done. Mm-hmm. Or that maybe Blake Bortles has had one or two or three important games where he's been able to be efficient. But, I mean, that wasn't the case against Buffalo in the wildcard round. It may have been the case in Pittsburgh, but it wasn't the week before. So I just think that you've got to look at just numbers and say that passing's the only thing that matters, or that running backs don't matter, or that, well, you know, Todd Gurley, why would you draft him? Why would you want someone like that early on when you could just find someone in the sixth round who can do this? I think he's just being a little bit ignorant of not only what we're seeing in the playoffs right now, and a little bit silly and a bit over the top with regards to the really talented. I think a good running back, there's nothing better than watching your team with a really good running game and a top-notch running back in the backfield. It's just fun to watch. And what I don't understand about some of these Seahawks fans is, I'm presuming they've lived through most of the Pete Carroll era and have been Seahawks fans during the Pete Carroll era. Well, how important was Marshawn Lynch to this team? You know, he was a first-round pick. I know that the Seahawks got him for a bag of balls when they traded him from Buffalo, but that's the Bills' problem, not the Seahawks' problem. The Bills spent a top 15 pick on Marshawn Lynch, and the question I would have for a lot of these guys is, if Marshawn Lynch was there in round one this year and was sat there at number 18, would you pass on him? I mean, would you pass on him because there's someone in the fifth or the sixth round that you'd rather have? And would that do more for the Seahawks than having Marshawn Lynch in the first round? So, look, I understand the passing efficiency. I appreciate the numbers. But, you know, I just think that there's a real danger that football is not maths. It's not always based around stats. There's a reason why three of the four teams in the NFL are playing great defense and running the ball. And there's a reason why a coach as good and as successful as Pete Carroll still buys into that philosophy.
Yeah, so to slightly play a bit of devil's advocate, and as I say, I agree with you first and foremost. I guess could the argument be made that the Vikings drafted Dalvin Cook and actually his absence hasn't made that much of an impact and they can still run it? So maybe it's the scheme of running as opposed to the personnel. I mean, is that partly valid?
Well, let me turn it on its head then. They spent a first-round pick on Teddy Bridgewater and they traded a first-round pick on Sam Bradford, and yet Case Keenum, who they got off the street, is helping them win at quarterback.
Very true. Like it. Someone's asked you that before, I reckon.
They haven't, no.
Oh, very good. That's very good.
So, obviously, the other major coaching change came on the defensive side of the ball, with Chris Richard effectively put on gardening leave for a few days while they sorted Ken Norton's contract out in San Francisco and brought him back after two seasons as the DC down in Oakland. First on Norton, though, while Pete Carroll's in the building, it's always Pete Carroll's defense, and as someone on Twitter referred to it, he just needs a joystick to run it, doesn't he, Rob?
Well, yeah, I think I've read that comment from Bucky Brooks, and maybe it's a tad disrespectful to Ken Norton. But I found, I don't know what you guys thought. I thought it was interesting. You kind of look at it two ways. One, I'm really happy that Ken Norton's coming back because I like Ken Norton. Who doesn't like Ken Norton? And sort of seeing him on the sideline shouting, you know, got 3 minutes for your damn life and all that when they were playing the 49ers is, you know, just sort of having that guy back on the sideline and seeing the reaction from people like Bobby Wagner and others say, you know, how happy they are that Ken Norton's back. You know, it's a really, I think it'll be a popular hire in that regard. But at the same time, you do wonder, you know, why hasn't Ken Norton ever been given a defensive coordinator job before? He's worked with Pete Carroll for a long time, and Pete's appointed about five or six different defensive coordinators at USC and Seattle and overlooked Ken Norton every time. And yet at the very, very end of his career, that's an assumption that I think you could make with some confidence, he's now turned to Ken Norton. So I think what it does is it shows that Pete's going to take even more control this year, and that Ken is probably not going to do that much of the scheming. He might not quite have the same role as Dan Quinn, Chris Richard and Gus Bradley, and might be there just to do what he does really well, which is to motivate, inspire, and get this physical toughness back on that defense.
Yeah, like a good cop, bad cop kind of thing,
a little
isn't
bit.
It? Yeah. So what on the other side of that is Chris Richard, who's, for me, was slightly unlucky to be fired. Obviously, he missed Richard Sherman, no Cam Chancellor, no Cliff Avril for most of the season. And the defense, apart from a couple of laps, is obviously the big one coming against the Rams. How do you think they handled all that with Chris Richard? Obviously, earlier today, he put out a statement where Pete Carroll was not mentioned, which has caught the attention of a few people.
Yeah, I noticed that. It's really hard. I mean, how do you fire somebody in the right way when you've worked with them pretty much since they're in, you know, a college player?
Yeah.
Pete Carroll's probably known Chris Richard maybe as long as anybody has sort of known Chris Richard, really, and in terms of his professional career. And then to have to fire him when he probably thinks, not unfairly, what a hand I was dealt this year, you know, losing so many key players, and the offense not being, I mean, think of the first sort of five, six games, the offense didn't do anything in the first half for weeks on end. And then, and the pressure was always on the defense. Think of the Green Bay game in the first game when the defense played pretty much the entire first half. Mm-hmm. And he probably thought, you're blaming me for that. You know, how was I supposed to put together a great defense? And then we lose so many players, Cliff and Cam and Richard Sherman, and Earl Thomas was missing for time again, and Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright missed time. So he probably feels a little bit hard done to. But Pete Carroll possibly feels like, and obviously I don't know. I don't know if you guys have any insight. It's something maybe Chris Richard wanted to do things a certain way and Pete Carroll wanted to do them another. Maybe he felt that Chris Richard wasn't sticking to certain game plans, or maybe he gave him a lot of rope and he found that Chris Richard wasn't doing what he wanted him to do, and he just wanted to take more control and felt like he had to make a change. I mean, they went to Gus Bradley first. They spoke to the defensive line coach about being the defensive coordinator as well. I think it was about getting somebody with Pete who he knew, and then Pete maybe sort of taking charge of this defense for at least 2018 anyway.
Yeah, Adam?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether you guys agree or disagree, but I actually felt that I thought Rashard has sort of found a groove in the last five or six games. I mean, one of the reasons that Seahawks used to be so fun to watch is that they were as enjoyable to watch on offense and defense. And I found that against Philadelphia and against Dallas, you know, the way they were, you know, being much more creative with blitzing, I found it really fun to watch them on both sides of the ball. And, you know, looking at some stats, I think in the last four games of the season, so after the Philadelphia loss, I believe, the offense averaged 52 yards in the first half and they averaged 3 points in the first half of the last four games. I mean, it's pretty harsh to really hang anything on a defense when the offense is that bad. And the other thing I'd say is that, you know, the NFL media insiders, they're quite vulturous in the way that they, you know, pick at things for news. And I didn't find it the most becoming in the way that, you know, people seem to have their jobs replaced without any formal announcements. I mean, it's a minor thing. It's not, you know, Chris Rashard's not my uncle or anything. It's not like I should care about him particularly. But I didn't feel that things were done in the necessarily the right manner. If that makes sense.
No, yeah, it's just all seemed a bit strange, a bit weirdly cloak and dagger. But yeah, with all the hirings and firings, has it changed much for the Seahawks draft board moving in? Obviously, they don't have many picks as we sit here. But does it change anything, or does it just reaffirm what you were thinking they were going to do anyway, Rob?
Well, I think he kind of reaffirms what I thought they were going to do, which was to try and repair the running game first and foremost. I'm not sure, you know, it's very difficult to do that when you've only got one pick in the first 2 days of the draft, which probably means they're going to end up trading down again, which a lot of people will probably pull a face at and think, oh, no, not again, because they've done that in the last few years and it hasn't really brought about great results in the second and third round. A few hits, but a few misses as well, and nobody of the kind of quality they drafted in the first two or three years. But they might have to do that because they just haven't got the draft picks. Unless they start trading, you know, big name players to get more stock, it just seems like an inevitability. And yeah, you know, the bringing in Solari, bringing in Schottenheimer makes me think that they are going to focus on the offense. They are going to focus on repairing the running game, whether that's O-line and running back. And they're probably going to bring younger guys onto the defense and coach them up, which is, I guess, Pete Carroll's speciality.
Yeah, so at 18, running backs, obviously Saquon Barkley's more than likely, unless he has a bit of a breakdown between now and end of April, is going to be long gone. Bryce Love has decided to stay at Stanford. Who are the names? Is it Ronald Jones at USC, or is 18 too early for him?
It might not be too early for him, but I really like Ronald Jones. So I think that he's a first-round talent. And if you took him at 18 or 20 or 25 or whatever, I think it'd probably justify, because I think he's so similar to Jamal Charles that if, you know, who wouldn't want Jamal Charles? Jamal Charles was a third-round pick when he was drafted by the Chiefs. But if you could go back in time, you know, and you do those things they do on NFL.com and ESPN, you know, do a redraft type of thing, Charles would have been a top 10 pick. So, you know, I think that Jones is very similar. And if he ends up having the same kind of impact to the next level as Charles, then he's definitely worth a first round pick. I just think that 18 is not a great, I think you can probably get some of these running backs later on. So, yeah. You know, I think that, as you mentioned there, Barkley's going to go in the top five. There's no question about that. But then you've got Ronald Jones a second, you've got Kerryon Johnson, you've got Nick Chubb, you've got Sony Michel, you've got Royce Freeman, you've got Rashad Penny, you've got Darius Geis, who I think is a little bit overrated, but you've got all of those players who could go between anywhere between 20 and 50. So, you know, in the next few weeks, I think it's about finding out where, you know, identifying the one or two guys that you really, really want and sort of trading back into a position where you can either take them or you take an offensive lineman first and then try and acquire a pick in either the late second or the early third round, which enables you to hit both positions.
Yeah, and obviously with Sonny Michel and Nick Chubb, if Schottenheimer was their coach two years ago in Georgia. I think Sonny Michel had a 1,000-yard year as well that season. I think it was the year Chubb got injured.
That's true.
Yeah, but at 18, can the Seahawks, with obviously limited picks and a clear issue that the running game is, can they afford like a luxury? I mean, me and Adam asked you about Roquan Smith before we started recording. Can they afford a pick which would be a perceived luxury pick like Roquan Smith would be, or another offensive player like an Anthony Miller wide receiver type, or do they have to just stick to need at this point?
No, I think they could take a defensive player. I mean, there are certainly I like Roquan Smith. I also really, I think that Tremaine Edmonds at Virginia Tech's going to be fantastic player at the next level. And I think he's, if he was there at 18, I think you sort of, you sprint to the podium and you just take him and you feel very happy about that. And the, and you just try and repair the running game in other ways. But I think he's probably going to go in the top 12, possibly top 10. So I don't think he's going to be there. And I don't think Smith's going to be there either. I think that a lot of the players that, if you notice, the three at Clemson, Austin Bryan, Christian Wilkins, and Clelin Ferrell have all returned to school. So there's two or three of those players might have gone in a range where, you know, ahead of Roquan Smith, depending on how they tested, and now players are going to get bumped up as a consequence of that. So Ferrell may have been a top five pick, would have been top 10. He's not there anymore. Everybody kind of shifts up one. And yeah. Roquan Smith, I think he's probably going to go, you know, there's Miami at, I think, 11, Cincinnati at 12, Washington 13. If he gets past all three of those teams, I think it'd be a little bit of a surprise. But, you know, I've just done a piece today looking at this, sort of how many legit first round prospects there are. There aren't that many. I personally think there's 11. And I think teams will, that's it, you know, and in a good year, you get about 20.
Yeah.
On average, it's about 15. And I've got 11 on, in my opinion. And I think that teams will probably be in that 10 or 15 range about there. Maybe some will have 16, 17 if they really like the quarterback class. So there aren't that many that at 18 that are going to last there. And you think, I've got to take this guy. And I think that the best value in this draft is going to be early. The guy you're taking at 35, for example, is probably going to be similarly graded to the guy you take at 20.
Okay. Yeah. Adam?
So from a general roster building perspective, when the season ended and coaches were probably going to lose their jobs, I sort of viewed this as probably going to be a down year coming with, you know, trading players away to get some picks for 2019 in conjunction with quite a few compensatory picks that I imagine they'd got. But now looking at the coaches they brought in, as you say, it all seems fairly short term. Do you think maybe that they're sort of thinking about, you know, putting the band back together for one final year to give it a real go, as opposed to maybe thinking about 2019 as the year to properly rebuild? And could that maybe be sort of leave us in limbo for both years? I mean, I'm coming at it from quite a pessimistic angle, obviously, but that's just the way I do sports as a fan.
I think it's somewhere in between. So I think there's going to be a bit of churn and some guys who will ultimately come back. So I think it'd be very difficult to move Richard. They're not going to cut Richard Sherman. If someone was willing to offer a second round pick, for example, they might think about it. But is anybody going to offer that with only having 1 year on his contract left, and also he's coming off a serious injury? So I think that Sherman will come back. Earl Thomas, it's really going to come down to his contract, because he's a free agent in a year. So if he's absolutely determined either not to sign a new contract, or if he wanted $15 or $16 million a year, for example, they're not going to do that. And they may feel like, or he may threaten to hold out, for example, if they start thinking about franchise tagging a year. So if you're going to do that, do you maybe have to consider moving him just to get what you can now, as opposed to only getting a third round pick in 2 years' time? That's one of the other things they have to consider. But I think Thomas will come back. I think they'll find a way to re-up his deal and keep him. But then you look at other players. So I think that Cliff, I know he said that he said on the NFL Network he's going to try and come back and play. And then today when he was speaking to Brock and Salk, he's kind of step back from that and said, look, quality of life is the most important thing for me, and that's all I'm focused on. So he, to me, seems like he's probably a player who really wants to play again, but maybe realizes that he can't, and is in a tiny bit of denial there, and sort of wants to, but maybe realizes he can't. And I think that ultimately he will retire. I think that Michael Bennett, one way or another, is going to go. I think they're going to move on, and I know people have said, how can you replace him? You're only going to save $2 million this year. But I think you have to look beyond that and say, yeah, okay, you only saved $2 million this year, but in 2019, his full $9 million is off the books. And if you wait 12 months to cut him, the saving next year is not much different. It's pretty similar. I think it's like $1.5 million extra. So if you're going to move on now. You know, don't delay this. You just get on with it. So there are two players. And then Cam, obviously, I think he's going to retire. I think that's pretty well established, despite what he was saying on Twitter, that he's going to retire. So if they do lose or move on from Bennett, Cliff and Cam, that is quite a churn. And then you are having to bring in younger players to sort of step up to the plate and replace those guys. So I think it is going to be a little bit of a churn. They are going to start that transition, but they will obviously keep some of the veterans, and I think we'll see KJ Wright, Richard Sherman and Earl Thomas still on this defense next year.
What about the three? Sorry, Stu. What about the three sort of marquee free agent names that are going walking out the door in Graham, Richardson, and Richardson? See, cause, you know, spending cap money for maybe 2019 a real go. I guess that's a consideration for some fans for not wanting to re-up, even though we could probably do with all three of them next season.
I think Graham will move on. I think that he probably doesn't want to come back. I think I imagine that he possibly feels like he didn't sign with the Seahawks as a free agent. They traded for him, and he went from an offense where he was putting up huge numbers with Drew Brees to an offense where they asked him to do things he knew wasn't really up to, it wasn't his best skill set. So like blocking, for example. So I kind of feel like, despite the friendship he has with Russell Wilson and that, he probably wants to move on. The Seahawks are probably willing to move on there as well. So I think Jimmy Graham will go. In terms of Sheldon Richardson, it's going to come down to cost. You know, personally, I think he'll hit the market, and then it will depend how much he's being offered. So if he gets there and his market's a bit like Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett in 2013, then he could come back. For example, if teams are willing to give him $8-9 million over 2 years or 1 year, maybe the Seahawks can find a way to bring him back. If somebody offers $15 million or 14, 16, that kind of range, then I think he probably moves on and they just take the third round comp pick that they're going to get. So I think that it's kind of flexible with Sheldon Richardson. As for Paul Richardson, it is a really good wide receiver group. They're going to be hitting free agency. You've got several big names in there, and they're all going to be competing for you know, the same kind of money. So you might see one or two or three get big contracts, but you might see one, two or three having to take 1 year deals and go somewhere else and play for a year. Now, Paul Richardson could be one of those who gets like a Robert Woods type contract, where he could be somebody who ends up having to play for a year. And if people remember a year ago, Alshon Jeffrey had to sign a 1 year contract, and Terrell Pryor had to sign a 1 year contract. And Jeffrey's gone on to sign a major extension, and prior his just season's been a complete write-off. So I think we may see one or two players do that. So the question for me with Paul Richardson is, one, is he the type of player who comes back for a year and has another year in Seattle or somewhere else? Or is there somebody else out there like a Marquise Lee or a Jarvis Landry or an Allen Robinson or, you know, somebody of that ilk who you bring in on a one-year deal, reasonable value, and you say, look, go and try and impress, and we'll, if you have a good year, we'll think about signing you as we did with Bennett and Avril, or you may want to go somewhere else and your market's a lot better.
With those three, do you think the 2019 comp picks will have any say in the decisions they make? Obviously, if they put a certain cap number on how high they go with the players, do you think 2019, obviously it's a bit of a way away, but do you think, because they're probably going to get third, fourth compensatory picks if they let those three, or something, if they let any of those three walk, aren't they? Should that be a consideration, or?
You know what? That I think a few weeks ago, people kind of assumed they'd get a load of comp picks for these guys. But what is actually Jimmy Graham going to get on the open market?
Yeah.
You know, he's probably going to need to get 10, 12 million to get a third, fourth round comp pick. And because the contracts are going up and because the cap keeps going up, you know, the teams that are going to, the players that get your third round comp picks now are going to be earning like $16-17 million. You know, it's got quite ridiculous. And if Kirk Cousins was on the open market, and if Sammy Watkins is on the open market, and if Sheldon Richardson's on the open market, and several others, and Allen Robinson and people like that, then it's going to be quite hard to see how Jimmy Graham, for example, maybe gets you a fourth round. Someone might offer him $6 million for next year, which isn't going to get you a huge comp pick return. And for Paul Richardson, if he's in the same range, again, it's not. I don't think it's going to get you a really, really high pick. So Sheldon Richardson is the one that might get you the best return. He's because defensive linemen and offensive linemen are in demand. He's the one who might get you a third round pick. And if he does it, I don't think the Seahawks are going to sign anybody for $13-15 million a year in the off season. So if he ends up going for that, then they'll get a third round pick.
Yeah, Adam.
No, I think that's about it. And I'm just thinking about some potential other drafting players, and maybe I'm jumping ahead a touch, but I've always had a real love for the player that Azeem Victor is, and what with KJ Wright potentially moving on, is there any chance that he might be a sort of a late round guy for the Seahawks? Because I would just love to see him staying in Seattle in the city.
I think given the issues that he's had, you know, he'd probably be somebody who's going to go undrafted or go in the very, very last round. So if that's the case, and they will have good intel on him because the relationship between the Seahawks and Washington seems to be good. They'll know everything about him. They'll know if he's worthy of an opportunity at the next level. And yeah, I could definitely see him being someone the Seahawks have a look at there. I think it's a really good linebacker group, actually. I think if they wanted to bring somebody in that range, on day three, there'll be possibilities there. You know, if they trade back a little bit, there's players like Rashawn Evans, Lorenzo Carter, Bieria at Washington. I think he's a really good player. You know, you've got a lot of players who could come in and offer some nice young depth at linebacker. I think there's, in terms of Seattle's biggest needs, which is kind of defensive front seven, whether that's D-line, linebacker, running back and offensive line, especially in the interior, there's a lot of really nice options in this draft. It's kind of a draft that has been, it's not got the greatest quality, but it's more or less tailor-made for the Seahawks. So they should be able to get at least one really good running back in this, if not two. You know, take one early and maybe one on day three. They should be able to get a good interior offensive lineman if they want to add to the competition there. And they should be able to draft for the defensive front seven and for the secondary as well. So I think there's plenty of opportunities for the Seahawks to come out of this draft feeling pretty good about their situation, getting younger, getting cheaper at some key positions, and starting that transition to sort of a new core.
Yeah, so league-wide, obviously, a lot of the attention leading up to draft will be, as it always is, focused on the quarterbacks at the top. People like Baker Mayfield seem to have shot up some draft boards. He's gone up in my estimation to how he was in the playoffs. He was, yeah, he was one reason that the Georgia made it so far and obviously almost won in the title game. Is he someone who could, like, set the cat amongst the pigeons in that first round? And as you mentioned earlier about people moving up one with Roquan Smith and out of Seattle's reach, is the quarterback position one that could help the Seahawks have someone like that fall down to them 18?
Yeah, absolutely. There's one problem, though, with the NFL, and you guys have probably noticed this as well, is that conventional wisdom is still prevalent. So, for example, Baker Mayfield is probably about 5'11", 6'4". And yeah, however well he played, and he was fantastic, you know, this year and won the Heisman Trophy, and you watch him play and you kind of see a little bit of Drew Brees, a little bit of Russell Wilson in there, and you think, how this guy can play. And I kind of like his sparky personality as well. It doesn't put me off at all. So I'm thinking, yeah, what a play. You know, could go in the top 10. And then I remember, hang on a minute, though. You know, Russell Wilson lasted to the third round. You know, teams will look at this guy. Here's the situation, because Drew Lock at Missouri, I don't know if you've seen him play.
Yeah.
He's not as good as Baker Mayfield, but he's like 6'4", 220 pounds, does, you know, looks like a quarterback. So there was a chance, if he chose not to declare, but there was a very good chance if he did, that he would have gone ahead of Baker Mayfield and would have gone in the top 15 purely because he is the prototype. Josh Allen, for example, might be the number one overall pick this year. And I'd probably say he's probably like the fifth best quarterback in this class, but he might go number one because he's the most... You look at him, oh, he's tall, he's mobile, he throws it downfield. You know, we can work with this. That's how teams, a lot of teams and a lot of their GMs and still very old school, think about this situation. They probably think Sam Darnold's a bit too creative, a bit, you know, he might go away from the game plan a little bit too much. You want someone who's going to go up there and do exactly what we tell him to do. And they look at someone like Josh Allen and think, we can teach him to do that. So that's, you know, Baker Mayfield is probably going to be a victim of sort of this conventional wisdom. And now there will be brave teams out there, and there will be a team that eventually takes him. But his talent's probably worth a top 10. He might end up going a lot later than that. I think I had him at 17 in my mock draft this week to yeah, LA to take him to work behind Rivers, because I think the teams will just... it does, conventional wisdom still does dog the NFL. And we're talking about Roquan Smith, just quickly on that. He'll find the same thing, because you watch him play and you think, wow, this guy's a first round pick. And then I bet if you spoke to people within the game, they would say, yeah, but he's only 6 foot and 220 pounds. So they probably think he's too small to play middle linebacker in any 3-4 scheme. And the teams that play 4-3 will probably say, yeah, but he's probably got the size of a Sam or a Will. And we want him to play middle linebacker. That's his best position. And he's probably too small for us. So we'll not think about that. Because Bobby Wagner's about 245 pounds. So there's like a 25-pound difference there. And he's taller as well. So teams will actually end up... I mean, I've read stuff that says Roquan Smith, really, really good, love him, intense, flies around the field, makes plays, does all this. But his size could keep him out of round one. And that's not going to happen. He's going to go in the first round. But he might end up going a tad later than he otherwise would do, purely because of his size, which is ridiculous. Look at Deion Jones.
Yeah,
it's amazing. When I started watching the NFL, I thought it was such like a progressive and modern sport, and in so many ways it is. But when you look at things, it really is like a jobs for the boys league, you know, in the same way as like Phil Brown lost a South End job today, but he'll get another job in 2 months' time because there'll be a team in League One or League Two that wants him. And it's funny that you talk about the conventional wisdom, because it actually segues into something that Seahawk Twitter has been going on about, that maybe our own quarterback is not the right guy to take us forward, which I find absolutely astonishing.
You know,
once you spend your entire life looking for a franchise quarterback, in my opinion, when you get one, you cling on to them for dear life, and retirement is the only thing that takes them away from you. Presumably, you're nowhere near the camp that suggests that Russell Wilson is the guy that should be out the door. I mean, there is a fairly prominent guy on Seahawks Twitter who's really good, but just, I don't know, maybe he's just got a little bit emotional in the past few weeks and wants the quarterback gone, but presumably you're not in that camp.
No, not at all. I mean, the two big sort of problems I have with Seahawks Twitter, and look, I'll not point the finger at anybody in particular, but it is the relentless obsession with the passing game versus the running game, and it is this sort of desire to knock Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson's not conventional, but Russell Wilson's probably one of the best 10 players in the NFL at any position. You know, it's just incredible to watch him play. It's a privilege to be able to watch every single one of his NFL games. And do you know what? There are some plays where he drops back and he runs into a sack and you get really frustrated and you curse at the TV and you maybe throw something at the screen. But then on the next set of downs, he will scramble away from trouble and do what he did against Arizona and throw it to Doug Baldwin, who was like, what, an inch away from the most impressive touchdown of the regular season. And you have to live with some of the little flaws that you have with Russell Wilson to have the extreme brilliance that you also get with him. And I think he led the league in touchdowns for the year. He was an MVP candidate, despite the fact that there was no running game at all. You know, he put up all of the production that he had, despite the fact that the only running back on the roster to get a touchdown was J.D. McKissic, and he's kind of like a half running back, half receiver anyway. I mean, like, to do all of what he did this year with no support whatsoever in the running game is incredible. And I would be surprised if the Seahawks share those opinions on Russell Wilson. Can you rein him in a little bit? Can he do things a little bit differently? Are there certain scenarios where he can be better? Yes, but you could say the same about probably any quarterback in the league, including Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers. There are little things that happen that you think, he just missed that there, or he didn't quite do that play right, or he's not stuck to the play call there, or whatever. And Russell's no different. And I think sometimes we kind of seek perfection when perfection is incredibly unlikely. And Russell Wilson is far from a problem in Seattle.
Yeah. But talking of the quarterback position in Seattle, obviously the backup was a bit of an issue and a sore point during preseason. Is that a position you see him taking a flyer on someone late, or is that another like Boykin situation with a drafted guy, do you think? And are there any names that are standing out to you 3 months before the draft who could fit that profile?
It's tough, because I think with the lack of picks that they've got, you know, spending one on a quarterback, you always kind of want to take one, and John Schneider kind of said that when he came in, and then he hasn't. But you do want to take one and develop one. I think the only one that comes off the top of my head, without sort of, I haven't spent a lot of time on the depth of quarterbacks this draft, but someone like Riley Ferguson, for example, might be someone that you could bring in and develop. It was the quarterback at Memphis. Apart from that, I think that there is some decent talent. I mean, there could be 5 first-round quarterbacks, for example, this year, as long as teams don't get silly about Lamar Jackson, who I think, you know, fully warrants going in the first round, because he's incredible.
Ferguson was the one who when I asked that question, he was the one I was thinking of. He's at the Shrine Game this week, and he weighed in 6'4" and 210 pounds, and someone referred to him as having the Tom Brady body, which I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, look, he's good. And the other guy that might be worth a shot, just because of the late round of that, it's not everybody's cup of tea, but, you know, like Luke Falk has got something about him. It's just that for whatever reason, and he did play for Mike Leach, so that might be why, he just never quite had a full season, if you know what I mean by that. You know, he was never quite consistent all the way through. You'd see some games where you'd think, wow, look at this guy. And then there'd be other games where you think, oh, no. You know, you can't draft him in the first 2 days. And if he was there, you know, in the back end of the draft, for example, if he lasted that long to take and sort of just have him learn the system and sit behind Russell, and maybe down the line he would have some value to somebody else, that would be an option. But I must admit, it's not a position that I'm ever really going to focus on, because the Seahawks haven't drafted one since Wilson, have they? So, you know, the chances that they're going to do it this year in the middle of a transition when they're trying to get younger on defense and repair the running game is perhaps unlikely. I mean, I could give you a list of several players that I like for day three, but quarterback is not really a position I've focused on too much so far.
No. What about, obviously we talked about Jimmy Graham leaving. Obviously, Luke Wilson's also a free agent, although it seems likely that he'll be back. It doesn't seem like it's, I think you said on Hawkblogger last week, it's not a position which has the depth that you say it has for like running back, for example. Who are the names that are standing out? Someone I've pointed Adam to is Dallas Goedert, however you say his surname, from South Dakota State. Is he someone who could be in the Seahawks crosshairs come April?
I hate to say it, having watched a bit of him, I thought he was just a guy. And yeah. I kind of felt the same about Mark Andrews. Andrews, for me, just makes plays on the very easy routes. I think I made the point to Hawkblogger that if you watch Mark Andrews at Oklahoma, when they played Georgia, they ran one route and it made for like a 20-yard completion. They went back to it a few drives later and it led to an interception because Georgia saw it and they knew what to do. And the good teams will do that. And Andrews, for me, is not the kind of difference-making athlete. Goedert isn't... trying to think of the other names that often get talked about.
Penn State, Gesicki, he's what?
Yeah, Gesicki. So he's another one. You know, he's big, doesn't block at all, and... You know, you just wonder how athletic he actually is. We'll see at the combine. Because if he tests through the roof, then someone will take him as like a glorified receiver. But I think the Seahawks want blocking. I think that they've lived through the Jimmy Graham experience. I think they want people who can block. I think they want people who can be more Zach Miller than Jimmy Graham. I think that we possibly will see Luke Wilson return, because by the looks of things, Schottenheimer does run a lot of H-back stuff. So, you know, maybe instead of using the fullback, you know, that's the kind of role that Luke Wilson has done a lot over the last couple of years. So I can imagine him coming back, and then I can imagine them possibly looking for finding somebody, you know, that like a Cooper Helflett type, something like that, who they bring in, or like a really cheap free agent, or even someone like Austin Seferian Jenkins, who seems to be working in the Seahawks front office these days since he was championing Marquise Lee coming back to Seattle. So maybe he's destined to come back to Seattle as well. We don't know. But I kind of see them going value and quite cheap at the position, but with a very specific skill set, which is first and foremost being able to block.
Yeah.
Is it fair to be slightly concerned about, just from a numbers perspective, where the touchdowns are going to come from in order to win enough games? Because if you, let's say that Jimmy Graham is going to leave, that's 10 touchdowns out the door. Let's say Paul Richardson isn't there, that's probably 6 to 7 touchdowns out the door. It slightly worries me that they're going to be heavily reliant on completely transforming that running game to get those touchdowns back, because as far as I can see it from a receiver position, you know, teams did start to, you know, rush three and drop a few more into coverage against us, and we did struggle. And it concerns me slightly that if Doug Baldwin's taken out the game, have we got enough touchdowns in the roster to really make a challenge?
I think it's a really good point. And there's sort of two ways that I think they might be able to combat that. The first thing is that I think they have to do something at receiver, and they probably have to get a bigger target. Now, whether that is someone like Seferian Jenkins at the tight end, he had like a 3-game stretch where he was unstoppable in the red zone. And then for some reason, the Jets kind of stopped using him there. Is he somebody who could come in and maybe not get 10 touchdowns or 11, but get 5, for example? Is that an option? Is there a big receiver they could bring in to sort of offer some of the relief in the red zone that maybe Jimmy Graham offered there? That's another possibility. And the other thing that I would say is that I think it'd be a more concerning thing if for example, they got like 6 or 7 rushing touchdowns last year. But the fact that they only had one by a running back, it's not beyond the realms of possibility to think that they might be able to get, for example, 11 rushing touchdowns next year if they get things. And that's not a, you know, teams generally have about 10 rushing touchdowns, 11 rushing touchdowns. It's not a stupid number. It's not like I've said 25 rushing touchdowns or anything like that. It's like it's 10. It's 10 to 12. And if they do that, well, that's made up for Jimmy Graham's lack of touchdowns. And then it's just a case of replacing Paul Richardson's, which hopefully they would be able to do, whether that's with Lockett getting a few more, whether that's a big receiver, whether that's a replacement tight end, whether that's Luke Wilson, whether that's whatever it is, getting a few more than 10 rushing touchdowns. I think there is a way to do that. I thoroughly appreciated what Jimmy Graham did for the offense. I thought he had a great year in the red zone, and it transformed, it stopped Seattle's red zone offense being a liability for the first time in years. But at the same time, I just wonder whether or not some of those touchdowns merely replaced the complete incompetent running game and the total lack of production there.
With that, you talk about the big body, maybe a target. I mean, Stu and I have said for quite a few weeks now that, and if this is probably not the way that you should construct a team, but I would like to see the best defensive player left on the board taken at 18, assuming they stick at 18. Is there a receiver out there that is A, feasibly going to be there at the time, and B, in your 11 guys that are worth a first rounder, that, that could be potentially a guy that could be taken at that position?
No, I don't. I think the best options of receiver are going to come on probably from around round 3 to round 7. I think it's going to be a good draft for receivers in that kind of range. And you, maybe someone like Javon Wims, who had a really good year for Georgia, for example, or Atterman at Oklahoma State. You know, there are big receivers who had good production and have proved to be really reliable in college that you can maybe get on the third day that are going to be better than the options early in the round. So I think that Calvin Ridley will go early. He's not a big receiver. I think he will go in the first round, but I've not got him as a first round grade. I think that he's just not spectacular enough in any way. He's just consistent, doesn't have size, doesn't have particularly great speed. And then you've got Cortland Sutton, who I really like, but I just wonder how his, you know, is he going to go in the Kelvin Benjamin type of range in terms of, you know, that sort of the 20s as opposed to earlier than that? And are the Seahawks going to, you know, go all in on a receiver in the first round when they've just had Pete Carroll come out in his post-game press, his postseason press conference and say, we need to run the ball, we need to do this better, we need to, you know, our running game is not good enough. And then they go and appoint Brian Schottenheimer as offensive coordinator, and they fire Tom Cable, and they seem to be making a move towards repairing this running game. I totally sympathise with the point you say about getting the best defensive player. And if there's a really good defensive player there, you know, if Tremaine Edmonds is there, if I don't think it'll happen, but if Vita Vea was there, for example, or if the Marcus Davenport was there, then it's something that has to be considered. But assuming that those players are going to be gone and there's a decent chance of that, then I genuinely think the best thing would be to do would be to trade down as far as you can, possibly into the early part of round two, and see what's there. Either go offensive line, go with someone like Isaiah Wynn at Georgia, go with a Frank Ragnow, go with a running back, whether that's Ronald Jones, Chubb, Kerryon Johnson, Michelle, you know, one of those players, or go with a defensive player, Lorenzo Carter, for example, at Georgia's, could be a you know, perfect type of Bruce Irvin type linebacker that they've not really had since Bruce left. And there's one or two others that could be in that, you know, defensive linemen, linebackers who could be in that range as well. So I think there's a, that would be the plan that I will be thinking of at the moment. I'd much rather they had the second and third round picks and just take the best player available at number 18. But seeing as they don't have that, I think they've kind of got to get more. They can't just pick once in the first three rounds.
Yeah. Is there like a Patrick Mahomes type, obviously not maybe a quarterback, but is there someone who's going to fall to that mid-team range? You can see a team doing what Kansas did and mortgaging their future on just that one player that could again fall back into Seattle's benefit?
Yeah, I've got a couple of thoughts. I think that there's at least a chance that Josh Rosen, I don't think he's going to, he might not fall as far as 18, but I think he might fall a little bit, because there's enough talk about the way his personality is and stuff like that, that makes me just wonder. Look, it's happened before with Aaron Rodgers, it's happened with other quarterbacks that, you know, they've just fallen further than anybody ever expected. And you just wonder whether that could happen with him. I still think he's going to go in the top five, but you just, it's an option. And Baker Mayfield's the other one who could fall into range when someone trades up. But having said that, you kind of have to look at why would they trade to number 18? Because Dallas are next at 19, and they've got Dak Prescott. And then at number 20, it's Detroit with Matt Stafford. So, you know, the chances of needing to get either ahead of those either of those teams to get a quarterback, it doesn't really seem to jive there. That it, I think if a team was trying to get up to number 18, it would be because they are not eyeing a defensive player that they think Dallas and Detroit might go for. And with Dallas needing to bolster their defense, and with Detroit set to appoint a defensive coordinator in New England, Matt Patricia as their coach, he might be thinking defense as well. I think it's for a defensive prospect that a team will trade up.
Yeah, obviously the Shrine Game is this week, and then it's the Senior Bowl. Is there anyone, obviously, firstly at the Shrine Game who you've got your eye on, and then obviously anyone who's caught your attention from the invitees to Mobile this year?
In terms of the Shrine Game, what I generally tend to do, Brandon Fakaisen is, or Faison, I'm not entirely 100% on the pronunciation. I've heard it mentioned both. He's the Virginia Tech cornerback. He's at the Shrine Game. He's got 32-inch arms, which we know is a kind of a tick-off point for the Seahawks at cornerback. And he had a really good first year at Virginia Tech, really stood out, really impressive, and then got injured, and he's never really recovered his form. But he is talented, and I wonder if he's somebody that they might look at. He's at the Shrine Game. They have drafted players who've participated in the Shrine Game before. I'll be interested to see how he develops. There are one or two defensive linemen at the Shrine Game who would be very interested to see as well. In terms of the Senior Bowl, there's quite a lot of big names who are going to be there. I mean, I think at the moment you're looking at, I mean, even Baker Mayfield initially accepted his invite, but then you've got, you know, players like Wims and Wynn at Georgia who've said they're going to be there. You've got, for example, I think Harrison Phillips has said he's going to be there with Stanford, BJ Hill, Marquise Haynes, the linebacker at Ole Miss. We'd be interested to see him. Quinn Blanding was a five-star recruit from Virginia who's a safety. He was going to be there. Atterman at Oklahoma State, the receiver I mentioned earlier, is going to be there. Terrell Edmonds, who was Tremaine Edmonds' brother, safety at Virginia Tech, I think might be there. So, and you've got a number of first rounds. This could be the best Senior Bowl. If all of the people who said they're going to be there turn up, this could be the best. This could be the best Senior Bowl week in a long time.
Yeah, Adam.
I think that's about me for the drafting side of things, Stu.
Yeah, cool. Is there any names who have stayed in school that surprised you, Rob? Obviously, Bryce Love said last night he came out and said that seemed to catch a few off guys. Are there any names that you surprised staying, especially at the running back position where you see obviously treading the tires is a big thing at that position?
Well, I think with Damian Harris at Alabama, it was talked about all year that he was thinking of returning. So it wasn't a huge shock when he, I mean, as talented as he is, and I think he could have gone in the first round, it always felt like he's like passionately, you know, Mr. Alabama. His girlfriend goes to the school. He loves playing for them. He has not taken the number of carries that Derrick Henry, for example, and Eddie Lacy and Ingram and the others took at Alabama. He's got fresh legs. And he might have been sold on the idea of a Heisman tilt next year. And if he gets the lead carries with Bo Scarborough going, then he could be a Heisman candidate for Bama. The running back at Alabama, if they ever have a feature back, and they're always going to be in line for a potential Heisman run. And Bryce Love seems to I can't remember the exact degree that he's doing at Stanford, but it seems to be quite a complicated one, and he probably feels like getting his Stanford degree is the most important thing to him, rather than declaring early for the draft, which is completely respectable. So, and understandable, you know, it's Stanford. It's not, you know, one of the smaller schools. It is Stanford. So I kind of get those two. I think the Clemson one, I like all of the reasons why these people have stayed in school. The Clemson guys are like, hey, look, there's the three of us. Let's all come back and try and win another national championship. And it might not be the best decision they make financially, but in terms of like the romantic side of the game and, you know, playing for the team and for each other, you've kind of got to respect the decision that they've made. And they have got another guy, Dexter Lawrence, I think he's called, who's on the D-line there, who's going to be a top 10 pick, I think, next year. So they could have four guys in the first round next year from the same defensive line, which would be pretty incredible. And they're going to be a real force next year with all those guys going back. Apart from that, I'm trying to think if there's anybody else who was a surprising return. I don't think so. I think, if anything, some of the declarations have been surprising. So Tim Settle declaring as a redshirt sophomore, for example, was, it's great to see because I'm a big fan of his, but wasn't expecting it necessarily. Sam Darnold turning pro was a little bit of a surprise, especially the way the bowl game ended against Ohio State. And it's been good to see all of the running backs declare because of the need the Seahawks have there. And I think that generally there's not been a huge surprise, just some very interesting moves.
Yeah, the Sam Darnold one was one. He's kind of like, it's like you kind of like, okay, if you want to do that, obviously it's his decision. But I think he definitely needed another year. Obviously, we're in the middle, as I said, the start of conference games are this weekend. The divisional last weekend, they were some pretty damn good games. I mean, if it isn't for Stephon Diggs, we're probably talking about one of the best quarterback performances in playoff history, aren't we? Robert Drew Brees in that second half.
Yeah, I mean, the way that they came back and they were hopeless in the first half, weren't they? And then the second half, it just seemed to get things going quite late in the game as well, wasn't it? It was like the end of the third and start of the fourth when you could just start to see it turn. And then when Minnesota got their field goal, you still felt there was a, you know, more than enough time for New Orleans to come back, as they did. You know, they left 20 seconds on the clock. You know, we know as Seahawks fans that that can be because of the Atlanta game, you know, back in 2012. And then the most incredible thing happened that, you know, you run that play 100 times and probably 100 times it just either the guy gets tackled in bounds or it goes incomplete. And it was just an incredible play. And the scenes afterwards, you know, seeing Case Keenum doing the skull thing and, you know, seeing Thomas Morstead come out there, you know, the punter who absolutely leveled the kick return on the opening kickoff of the game and played with broken ribs. And then he's the one out there, stood like he was like Mel Gibson in Braveheart or something, kind of stood there at the line. You know, he's the only one from the Saints who'd gone out there to face the extra point. And then I think the Vikings fans have donated $25,000 as of recording this podcast to his charity because they just admired the way that he played the game, the Saints punter, which was a really nice story. So it was just an incredible game. I think if you were hoping that Tom Brady wasn't going to win another Super Bowl this year, or the Patriots weren't, then the best thing was that Drew Brees and New Orleans won that game. But it still made for a great finish and a great story.
I think the final kneel down was a rare play where he had both punters on the field at the same time.
Yeah,
which is not something you see very often. But yeah, but it was quite a second half, wasn't it, Adam?
It was amazing. I mean, it's funny that you say about that it was late. I always feel like the third quarter is the one that somehow just sort of vanishes during the evening. Like you're all of a sudden, like you turn around and it's like 14 minutes and 50 seconds to go in the fourth quarter, and you swear it was like halftime 5 minutes ago. I don't know how that always seems to happen. It was amazing. And Breeze, it was surgical. I mean, for a guy, you know, not young by any stretch, 38 years old, to just be so on point. And the NFL just has, people can moan about it being slow or whatever, but it's amazing that a 4-hour game, and same with the Pittsburgh-Jacksonville game, can feel like it's going by in an absolute flash when every play is just so gripping. And we haven't had the greatest set of playoff games in the last few years, I wouldn't have thought, just off the top of my head. So it's been really good to see. And, you know, in a year of adversity and talking about ratings and, you know, people doubting the sport, it's been cool to see like a real comeback weekend probably the best weekend of the year, to be honest, the divisional round games.
Yeah, and obviously it sets up an NFC title game, which is the Jeff Fisher Bowl with Nick Foles and Case Keenum. While they were playing under Jeff Fisher, they went a combined 11-18, and without Jeff Fisher, they are a combined 33-22, which is, and they've thrown for a combined 80 touchdowns and just 35 interceptions, which doesn't do a lot for Jeff Fisher's future employment prospects. Adam,
just say that I felt so happy for Case Keenum. I mean, I don't know if you remember Hard Knocks and also All or Nothing. Some of the most poignant scenes I've seen in sort of any sporting documentary, when him and his wife are going through the playbook when they're making dinner or whatever. And it was just, I felt at times with that, they were, you know, you just knew they were waiting to be cut and waiting for the next move, and there was just nothing going right for them. And, you know, nothing going right is obviously a bit of a trite thing to say about a guy still making a couple of $1 million at the time, but I just felt so pleased for him. And yeah, he seems such a nice guy that, it, you know, getting to lead the skull chant, and when his face, when they slowed it down, him just saying, "Oh my God," when he realised what had happened with the play. Like, it's little moments like that I think is why everyone loves sport, really, isn't it?
Yeah. All the mic'd up stuff in the locker room is pretty cool from him as well. And obviously, he's someone, Robbie, who had a pretty record-busting college career, didn't he, at Houston as well? He threw everywhere and all the yards.
Yeah, he did, and there's just something about him. It's a great point, you know, watching the Hard Knocks thing and the way that he was with the Rams, and then just a guy that you'd want to have, you know, that you'd want to have on your team. He was just constantly competing. You know, he kind of embarrassed Jared Goff as much as anything in that, you know, the way that he was taking the lead of that team and just sort of, you know, conducting himself with great intensity and desire and wanting to get things done. And then you've got Jared Goff kind of slouching around, you know, looking like a school kid. Like, it just, and it's not a surprise that he's almost like willed it to happen for him, you know. And he's got in there, and even Mike Zimmer was like coming out his press conferences during the regular season and talking him down a little bit and talking about Teddy Bridgewater a lot. And, you know, well done to Case Keenum, and it'll be interesting to see what the Vikings do with him now, you know, whether they keep him, whether they give him a huge contract, which is probably going to take to keep him, or whether he goes somewhere else and makes a lot of money somewhere else.
Yeah. Adam, do you want to move on to your favourite weekly thing on this pod?
Yeah, so Rob, what we've recently instituted is we have a proverbial bin, and someone around the NFL, we each get the chance to put someone in the proverbial bin that sort of doesn't deserve to have any respect passed this way. I'm trying to think who I'm going to put in there this week. Some of the Steelers play calling, you know, Todd Haley's lost his job by the looks of it, and a couple of times out on the fourth and one, but I think ultimately my place in the proverbial bin is whoever decided that the Steelers should go with an onside kick with 2.5 minutes to go. I cannot understand the logic with that. Bear in mind they knew they were going to have to, you know, make Jacksonville go 3 and out. Why would you not want to do that near their end zone as opposed to near where they can kick a field goal for you? And ultimately, that pretty much cost them the game. So whoever made that call from the Steelers, I mean, it doesn't help. It was one of the worst onside kicks I've ever seen. Boswell has got history with his Rabona efforts as well. He's not the best at that, by what I can tell. So, yeah, they're in my proverbial bin for the week.
Yeah, I don't think I've got anyone this week. Yeah, the two games on Sunday were... I can't think of anyone to put in. I think I'm going to spare everyone. Rob?
I'd like to put Bruce Arians in the bit, just because I liked his kind of brash honesty as much as anybody else, but I just found him quite annoying as well, especially when he was used to come to Seattle and beat us in Seattle. We'd beat them in Arizona and they beat us in Seattle every year. So yeah, off you go, Bruce. You can go in the bin now, you've retired.
He's had two goes in the bin now, so he's doing well.
Yeah.
But funnily enough, I mean, he was on with Colin Cowherd. I mean, it's not a show that anyone would want to listen to either of those two guys, to be honest. But he said that Nick Saban wanted the Giants job, and then 2 days later said, oh yeah, I completely made it up. So I don't know if that's the way he's going to carry out his media career. But if he does, I mean, he'll, just for making up random rumours, he'll fit right into the NFL network, that's for sure. I'm not really convinced that that's how you can conduct a media career, but you know, if that's the way Bruce wants. And obviously he was still wearing his stupid Kangol hat indoors during an interview. It's just funny old bloke.
Yeah, if he's lied that blatantly, it's a rare occasion where Colin Cowherd is the better man in the room, I guess. for a change. But Rob, obviously this is your third or fourth time, but if people haven't followed you or found your website yet, where can people go to and to read up on all the drafters? Obviously, drafting really starts to kick up in the next 2-3 weeks with the Shrine game and Senior Bowl, and then Combine 6 weeks away, I think. Rob?
Yeah, I can't believe it's so close already. You know, it feels like yesterday that we were doing the Combine stuff last year. But, you know, it's all coming out. You know, we do a lot of the Senior Bowl coverage. The Combine stuff is just, you know, I take time off work. We just sit there all day and watch the whole thing and break it down. We will learn a lot about who the Seahawks might draft during the Combine. And we'll just keep it going all the way through to April. So it's a great community of people who on the blog. You know, it's very un-internet-like that the people who comment on the blog in the comment section tend to get on with each other and they don't say things like running game doesn't matter. So if you want to come and be part of that community, then please do it. It's SeahawksDraftBlog.com, all of one word. And on Twitter, if you can put up with a lot of tweets about South Yorkshire football, then there's also a bit of Seahawks stuff on there as well. It's at Rob Staten.
Yeah, cool. So the chapter website, obviously, with the Seahawks coming over to London, that was a pretty cool and a pretty chaotic day last Thursday, but the Seahawks finally come over to London, Rob. I'm sure you'll be on the first train down to the Big Smoke, won't you?
Yeah, on the day that the news broke, I immediately booked a week off work, and I'm going to try and get down to as much stuff as I can. They do a lot of press events and like open practices and stuff, or they have done in the past with some of the teams. So I'm hoping they're going to do that again. Just going to jump into it, going to try and interview some of the players. Hopefully we'll still like them after doing that, and then watch the game. And I'm really looking forward to coming to the Spurs new stadium. You know, Spurs are just the look of it. It looks great. Spurs are a club that I've got a lot of time for. There was a couple of kids when I was a young lad. The kids across the road from us were Spurs fans. Their dad was from North London, and they were Spurs, so I was very familiar with the club. They've progressed into a club that I think everybody who is an England fan sort of respects the way that Spurs are going about it, and the fact that they're producing like all of England's best players as well is good. So you know, I've got a lot of time for Spurs. Can't wait to see the Seahawks play there. And it also may save some miles flying out to see them this year, that they're just going to be down the road instead. So, and I hope they enjoy it as well, because I know the Ravens got hammered by the Jaguars, and afterwards John Harbaugh was saying, we'll never do this again. And I hope the Seahawks have a really positive experience. I hope they enjoy London, and I hope they win the game against the Raiders as well and feel like it was a thing worth doing.
Yeah, as I said last week, it's a pretty box office game as well, with obviously Marshawn Lynch possibly being on the opposite side, and then John Gruden against Pete Carroll as well. Obviously, we will be Seahawks, UK Seahawks events over the weekend. That will all be sorted in the next coming weeks. Obviously, keep an eye on the website ukseahawks.com and the Twitter at Seahawks UK and the Facebook page UK Seattle Seahawks fans for all the information on what we can sort and arrange with ticketing and other things. Also, the podcast is on Instagram at The Pedestrian Podcast, and Twitter's at Stu_Court, at Rossbell1984, and at Adam D. Nathan. Before we go, though, a quick note just to pass on. Obviously, Seattle, obviously, people may not be hot on geography, is in Washington State, and there's a bit of rivalry between the two major colleges in that town. That was swept aside last night. I would just like to pass on to any listening to any listeners who are Washington Cougar fans, our deepest condolences to all the family, friends, teammates and coaches after the tragic and sad passing of the redshirt sophomore quarterback Tyler Helinski overnight. It's pretty as tragic as it gets, isn't it, Adam?
Yeah, it's terrible, and as you say, we can only pass on our condolences and love to anyone that's affected. Just terrible news.
Yeah, it's really, really just brings certain things home. But yeah, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast. We'll be back in a few weeks. Enjoy the conference championship games. Thanks a lot, Rob, for joining us again.
Anytime, guys. Anytime. Loved it.
Cool. And this is the Pedestrian Podcast. Until next time.
Go Hawks.
Now's giving way to the backup. Is Helinski open? River Craycraft. Touchdown. First career touchdown pass for Tyler Helinski, 71 yards.
That is going to do it. 12, they're bringing the trophy home. Your Seahawks, Super Bowl 48 champions.